Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading, My Fiancé Went Missing 6 months ago, and everyone's convinced I killed her. Last night my doorbell camera caught her standing across the street, staring at our own house from the edge of the cornfield. This is by Unalloyed St. Trina from Reddit. I hope you enjoy this story, and a huge shout out to my patrons for making this episode possible. Go buy a Stories After Midnight t-shirt. Alright, let's get started. When Rose vanished, Detective Hughes seemed damn certain he'd discovered where I'd buried her body. I told him I had nothing to do with it. Over and over, I explained that he was squandering precious time. I begged him to consider other possibilities, pleaded for him to expand the search. You know what I got in response? A crap-eating grin and some old-timey, "You're going away for a long time, pal," cop speak. The smugness of it all made me want to bash my head against the cell wall until my skull collapsed. Can't say I was surprised, though. Some small part of myself knew I was screwed from the jump. Rose had no enemies. I had no alibi. Of course he thought I'd killed her. What other explanation could there be? We were home that day. Just the two of us. Rose went outside to stick a for sale sign in the roadside, even though I told her it was a waste of energy. I'd lived in that house my entire life, inherited from my parents when they passed. Labeling it secluded was a generous understatement. If someone ever drove by, it was because they were very, very lost, and probably not in the market for a beat-up farmhouse. Still, she was insistent. A sale would have financed the wedding Rose always envisioned for us, so damn it, she was going to figure out a way to sell it. And that meant trying everything, including the sign. Rose was stubborn like that. Fiercely. Unapologetically bullheaded. Always had been. During the winter of 96, her family's golden retriever ran out onto a frozen lake and fell through the ice. Her mom screamed for her to stay put, but the command didn't even slow her down. She dove headfirst into the water, and Rose couldn't save the drowning dog, of course. I mean, what are the odds of any 8-year-old girl could have? That wasn't the point, though. If she wanted something, she'd do everything in her power to make it manifest, no matter what anyone said, and no matter the cost. In that case, the cost was pretty steep. 8 days in the hospital, $30,000 in medical expenses, and a trio of amputated toes. Frostbite had devoured the smallest three on her right foot, left each of them dust-colored and brittle like an eggshell. You'd think losing some digits would have dented her natural resolve, but not Rose. Her ability to walk was never the same, but she wobbled with her chest puffed out, emerald eyes gleaming with this inextinguishable fire. Her expression steadfast and sure, even when the kids at school mocked her, nicknaming her Two-Toed Rose. Naturally, I didn't bother to fight her on the for sale sign. Instead, I grabbed a beer from the fridge, slumped onto the couch, and tried to unwind. "Be right back," she called out. 15 minutes later, my stomach was warm with lager. But she hadn't come back in. I wasn't worried. What was there to be worried about? I would have heard if there was trouble. The only ambient noise this deep into the heartland was the wind whistling softly between the corn stalks. My head began to feel pleasantly heavy. I let my eyelids flutter and fall. Woke up with a start, lurching upright, caked in cold sweat and gasping for air. Hours had passed. The night-swept house curled around me, grimly silent. I called out to her, but to no avail. Rose wasn't inside. My truck was still in the driveway. I ended up skipping the worried phase and proceeded straight to borderline hysterical. I bolted up and down the road screaming her name. Then I called Dan. To my profound relief, he answered his cell on the first ring. Lord only knows how someone born in our sad excuse for a shed ended up becoming the assistant to Minnesota's district attorney, but in that moment, I was grateful. My older brother pulled some strings, and within hours, droves of policemen were buzzing around the farmhouse. I sat on the porch and let them work, out of my hands, out of my mind with anxiety. Sniffer dogs had no difficulty picking up her scent, but as soon as they entered the cornfield across the street, the pack of German shepherds turned rabid, barking, whining, spinning in manic circles, biting wildly at each other. Detective Hughes told me that their abrupt frenzy indicated that the scent trail had gone cold, and that was a normal, expected reaction. The confusion painted across their handler's face seemed to suggest otherwise. A day later, I was arrested and charged with Rose's murder. The police razed that cornfield, unearthing every speck of dirt in a half-mile radius, searching for Rose's corpse, but found nothing at all. No blood, no body, no for sale sign, nothing. Other than the testimony of a few malfunctioning sniffer dogs, there was no objective evidence that I'd killed her. So the case never went anywhere, and they eventually had to let me go. In the trial of public opinion, however, I was guilty by default. When someone's wife disappears, it's always the husband's doing. Isn't that right, Frank? Is what Rose's father screamed at me when I dared show my face at the local grocery store. In the wake of her disappearance, everyone seemed to gloss over the fact that Rose and I never had the wedding, an honorary promotion to husband and wife, excruciating and ironic in equal measure. The man chased me all the way to my truck, angry tears spilling down his unshaven cheeks, white-knuckled fists hammering the driver's side window, splintering the glass while my trembling hand fumbled to shove the key into the ignition. "Where the hell is my daughter, you sick son of a bitch?" he bellowed as I sped away. I didn't have the answer, but he believed I did, and that was my true cross to bear. I was just as desperate to know what happened to Rose as anyone else, but I had no community to fall back on. The only person who stood by me was Dan, though I could never tell if that was because he actually believed I was innocent, or if he was trying to save face, maintaining appearances to sidestep the bad PR of being related to a killer. I trained myself not to think about it. After the incident with Rose's father, Dan offered to deliver food and booze to the farmhouse every Saturday, on the condition that I kept a low profile. That was fine by me. As long as the rations kept coming, Dan could believe whatever he wanted. The days were long and miserable, but the nights were worse. I couldn't sleep. My mind was foggy in the daylight, but as soon as the sun set, it would go into overdrive. I found myself haunted by the same three impossible questions, night after night after night. Where was Rose? Who took her? Were they outside right now, lurking in the cornfield, preparing to take me too? If I was ever going to sleep again, I needed some sort of protection, but Dan refused to bankroll a security system for the house. I'm already splitting the cost for these deliveries. Sure as hell not going to fork over another grand for cameras on that godforsaken house. His reluctant counteroffer was for me to move in with him and his family. Told him that wasn't going to happen. I can't just leave. If Rose ever comes home, I need to be there, I claimed, though if I'm being honest, I held no hope of her returning home. Still, I wouldn't leave. Leaving that house felt akin to a confession. I refused to give anyone that satisfaction. In the end, the doorbell camera was our compromise. I could afford a cheap one with basic motion detection capabilities. I had it mailed to Dan's house, and he brought it in with the next delivery. 6 months passed. Never got a single notification. Not until this morning. I woke up around noon, more hungover than usual. I rolled off the couch, gripping my head, acid slithering up the back of my throat. The air in the dimly lit foyer was hot and putrid. I gagged, stumbling around, ankles knocking into empty bottles, causing them to roll. The clinking of glass colliding with glass aggravated my already pounding headache. I wobbled down the front hallway. Sunlight would be torture, but I was willing to endure it for fresh air. I slammed my eyes shut, twisted the knob, and staggered onto the porch, breathing deep. Then there was an unexpected crunch beneath my bare foot, followed by a visceral squish. I lifted my foot and forced myself to look, grimacing as the daylight needled my throbbing eyes. The remains of a large brown moth lay smeared across the hardwood. Although I had crushed it, I was fairly sure I hadn't killed it. A handful of identical moths were scattered across my porch, and all of them looked to be dead. I surveyed the yard. There weren't any other dead moths lying in the grass or baking on the asphalt. I shrugged, planting myself on a nearby chair so I could pluck the sticky debris out of my skin. That's when I noticed something bizarre. I counted at least 20 tiny legs splattered across my heel. Moths didn't have that many legs, do they? My pocket buzzed. I scraped the last bit of insect off my skin and pulled my phone from my sweatpants. Sparks flew up and down my spine as I stared at the notifications lingering on screen. Motion alert, 3:28 a.m. Motion alert, 3:44 a.m. I watched those recordings with wide, unblinking eyes. And for the first time since Rose vanished, my mind felt clear. I knew what to do next. Dan, this is the last favor, I promise. Static hissed over the spotty connection. I sat on the porch, monitoring the cornfield, scrutinizing each individual stalk with a fervish intensity. You need to get Detective Hughes over to the farmhouse ASAP. She's still here. I saw her. Black clouds congregated on the horizon, portending a deluge. Motion alerts. 3:25. Early morning. Kitson County, Minnesota. 3:28 a.m. A silhouette pops into view on the other side of the pothole-ridden street. There's no footage of them walking into frame. No video evidence of them emerging from the vast cornfield on the opposite side of the street. They just appear. Their stance is stilted and awkward. Head forward, legs apart. Stretched arms held down and at an angle, palms facing the camera. They remain motionless for 16 minutes. Their stillness is so perfect that the recording appears frozen. Details about the silhouette, what they're wearing, their facial features, the presence of any injuries are hard to discern because of their distance from the camera. 3:44 a.m. A moth lands on the lens, obscuring the cornfield and the silhouette with its wings. After a few seconds, the moth listlessly falls from the lens, and the cornfield returns to view. The silhouette is gone. Not only that, but the location where it had been standing is different. Some of the nearby stalks have vanished. Others are missing only pieces, severed cleanly from the stalks at bizarre angles. There! She's right there! I bent over the detective's shoulder and jabbed the top left corner of my laptop, pixels distorting as my fingernail dug into the screen. Detective Hughes leaned over the kitchen table, squinting, cocking his head, studying her. Outside, rain pelted the gutters. My anxious heartbeat sort of mimicked the downpour. Quick, arrhythmic bursts of sound and motion. Why was he being so quiet? I know the feed is hazy. I paused, unsure of what I was going to say next. But that's definitely Rose. I don't know why she's standing like that. I don't know why she never came inside last night, but damn, she's alive. Rose is alive. The thud of my laptop slamming shut severed the stream of consciousness. Detective Hughes stood, pulled his raincoat from the rim of the chair and began sliding it on. So, did you email it to yourself, or... He paced out of the kitchen, stepping over empty beer bottles and plates of rotting food, navigating the minefield of detritus that acted as a physical testament to Rose's prolonged absence. Wait, you're reopening our case, right? I called after him. I followed him into the foyer. The man was practically sprinting out of my house. As his hand gripped the front doorknob, he spat a few harsh syllables under his breath. I felt heat gnawing at my ribs. What the hell did you just say? I shouted. Hughes tensed his shoulders. He released the knob and slowly turned to face me. His bloodshot eyes were bulging. A bright blue vein pulsed beneath the skin of his temple. I said, this is the last damn time I ever do your brother a favor. His hands flew into the air, gesticulating wildly. For crap's sake, Frank, I know you're desperate for the world to believe you didn't kill her, but that had to be the laziest, most pathetic attempt at Photoshop I've ever seen. What? None of that was photo... Hey, he barked, stomping across the foyer, crushing frozen meal boxes beneath his boot heel, squaring up to me, nose to nose. Lips contorted into a snarl. I shut my mouth and sheepishly tilted my head to the floor. Distant lightning fractured the sky, bathing the room in a pearly flash. Hughes lowered his voice to a sharp whisper. How dumb do you think I am, bud? You Really? Expected me to believe you got a motion detected notification for something that far away from the camera? You getting a notification every time a sparrow flies over the cornfield too? My heart sank. I hadn't considered that. And by the way, those corn stalks are at least 7 feet tall. So next time you try to pull a stunt like this, it might be a good idea to make her shorter than the stalks, not half a head taller. I hadn't considered that either. Turns out the pure relief of seeing Rose again had blinded me. And when that blindness lifted, some unnerving irregularities began settling in my blood like drying cement. My entire body felt numb and heavy. I stared at the floor. What the hell was on that video? Hugh slapped a hand onto my shoulder. My eyes snapped back to him. Rows of cigarette-stained teeth shone through a hollow grin. "Great talk," he mumbled, releasing his palm. He trudged across the foyer and swung the front door open. The thumping clamor of a rainstorm erupted into my home. "One last thing," he shouted from the doorway. "Let's pretend you weren't god-awful at video tampering, and I believed what you said was on that recording. Isn't it kind of suspicious that the first thing you did was devise a way to get me over here rather than look for Rose yourself?" Hughes flipped his hood up and stepped into the downpour, leaning out of the frame while holding the door open, gesturing to the cornfield. "She's right there, Frank. A little rain really going to stop you from finding your beloved?" I stared at the man, searching for something to say. He sighed. "Listen, judging by the rust, I'd bet good money your truck is just an expensive metal sofa at this point. So, want to lift into town? I don't know whether or not you killed Rose, but I know that Dan cares about you, and I know this hellhole is poisoning your mind." A dormant rage reignited in my gut. "I did not kill her, you vapid, miserable bastard." Each syllable fired from my diaphragm like a pistol shot. My rage echoed through the empty corridors, blanketing the ruins of my life in a layer of harsh, blood-red noise. That echo slowly faded. I steadied my labored breathing. "Now, get the hell out of my house." He chuckled, turned, and plodded into the storm. Frozen in the center of my musty, poorly lit, trash-laden foyer, I watched the door gradually sputter closed, jerking on its hinges, and for a second, my eyes latched onto something. A long-legged silhouette looming atop the weathered yellow road markings, a featureless outline glistening in the relentless downpour. Then the door clicked shut. I bolted to the room's front-facing bay windows and pressed my face into the murky glass, stomach twisting, lungs on fire. "What the hell? What the hell? What the hell?" I whispered, eyes darting across the road. I scanned every inch of it, once, twice, three times, and all I saw was the headlights from the detective's sedan growing dimmer and dimmer on the horizon. It took about an hour to settle my screaming nerves. I darted from window to window, peering out into the storm, frantically surveying the perimeter for whatever I thought I saw, hoping that would calm me down. The patrol backfired. My imagination projected the long-legged silhouette into every dark corner of the overwhelming gloom, elevating my panic to new heights. Autopilot took over. I paced into the foyer, brandished a half-filled bottle of scotch that was resting on the coffee table, and began chugging. My nervous system cooled. The panic faded. I finished the last sip with a wheezing cough. I tossed the bottle into the already cluttered fireplace and stumbled into the kitchen, collapsing into the chair Hughes had been sitting in. "Asshole," I muttered, staring at the closed laptop. Gusts of wind battered the house, whipping the rafters, causing the walls to creak and moan. Loose gutters crashed against the side of the roof. I wedged my fingertips under the display and slowly pulled it up. The screen flashed to life and the footage resumed. I studied the motionless silhouette. The more I examined it, the less it looked like Rose. The arms were too skinny. The head was too long. The body appeared flat, paper thin, and almost two-dimensional. But the face was right. The button nose, the rounded chin, the fire glinting behind their eyes. My phone clattered against the table. I gasped, clutching my chest, heartbeat striking my palm. Damn. I picked it up and answered without checking the caller ID. Dan's gravely voice buzzed through the receiver. I just got off the line with Hughes. What the hell happened, man? I clicked the space bar. The timestamp at the top of the recording stopped ticking. Same old stuff that always happens. He didn't believe me. I swear I could point out the flaming orb in the sky and call it the sun, and these people would still label me a liar. The room began to spin. I closed my eyes and rested my forehead on the keypad. God, Frank. Every day you sound a little more like Dad. What's that supposed to mean? A hint of regret crept into Dan's voice. You know, just nothing was ever his fault. Not the divorce. Not the drinking. None of it. Hell, even some issues back when we actually owned the house and the farmland. I felt myself drifting from the conversation. The hypnotic thumping of rain was more significantly palatable than another one of my brother's sermons. The phone vibrated against my ear. I shot upright and peered at the screen. My guts twisted into violent knots. Motion alert, 10:32 p.m. I scrambled to switch to the live feed. Dan droned on in the background. Remember how Dad would always lose things, but he'd never own up to it? It was pathetic. The man would blame the cornfield before he blamed himself. Said the land was slippery and cracked at the seams. I furiously examined the black and white image. Stalks wavered in the bellowing wind. Lightning flickered in the background. No silhouette, no moths, no motion. There was this one time when you were still a baby. It was in the middle of the night. I woke up because Dad was yelling, probably drunk. But he wasn't arguing with Mom. He was on the porch screaming into the dark, howling the phrase, "Give it back," over and over and over again. I rewinded the feed to exactly 10:32. Still, the cornfield was vacant. Something had set the detector off. Where the hell was it? And I saw it, not in the cornfield, but much closer to the camera, hanging over the porch awning. A bulbous, rolling pin-shaped knob with two thin, crooked, wriggling protrusions curling over at the ends like cricket antennae. Those protrusions hooked onto the awning's edge and pushed up, quickly disappearing from the feed. Recognition came in small, venomous drips. An old nickname began rattling around my skull. Two-toed Rose. Without warning, the rain became louder, less muted. Droplets clinked against the empty glass bottle scattered around my foyer. The music of her arrival. I slid the phone into my pocket and stood with as much grace as my drunken limbs could muster, careful not to squeak the chair legs against the tile. Bouts of wind howled within the next room. I took slow, silent steps, bringing the foyer into view. Silver moonlight bathed the waterlogged couch in an eerie glow. I didn't understand, but I couldn't see the roof. I leaned forward. There was a hole, a narrow hole with smooth, rounded edges. Maybe slit is more appropriate word. It was long, and from my vantage, I couldn't see how long. I leaned a little more, but stopped before I saw the end. I squinted. Motes of dust danced in the moonlight, swelling, ballooning towards me, forming shapes that caused waves of primal distress to explode across my skin, but I couldn't run. Not yet. Not until two ghastly emeralds gradually shimmered into existence, getting closer and closer, and then a rounded chin and a button nose. She was right in front of me. I could only see her semi-translucent face, superimposed over the foyer. It crinkled the atmosphere as she pushed closer, like forcing a mask through a layer of saran wrap. Her expression was one of contentment, cheeks raised with a wide, toothless smile. But it was still wooden, nearly lifeless. A wispy sensation tingled along my right palm. I think she was trying to hold my hand. I almost smiled. Rose had found a way back to me. Scorching pain engulfed my entire hand, feeling like hundreds and hundreds of insect legs burrowing into my flesh. I leapt back, wailing in agony, terror squeezing my heart, but it was too late. I threw myself around and sprinted towards the back door. I stretched my hand out to grasp the knob, but something went wrong. I could feel my palm and my fingers, but they hadn't moved to the door with me, Somehow they remained in the center of the kitchen. I looked down. My hand was just gone. Silently stolen, severed cleanly at the wrist. A jagged layer of blackened flesh covered the wound as if I'd pushed the stump against steaming metal until it sizzled. I felt her approaching, slinking closer with every passing second, but I couldn't stop gawking at the empty air where my hand should have been. I couldn't move, couldn't leave. I was going to die in that miserable, godforsaken house just like Dad did. Spark caught fire behind my eyes. I twisted the knob with my other hand, rammed my shoulder into the door and descended into the inky darkness. Heavy rain peppered my eyes, blurring my vision. Mud swallowed my bare heels with every step. I didn't look back. I just kept sprinting towards the truck. I felt her. She wasn't far behind. I swung the door open and launched myself into the driver's seat. My stump collided with the gear lever. Unbearable pain radiated up my arm. The syrupy warmth of leaking blood trickled across my wrist, and I screamed through a tense jaw and chipping teeth. I sucked down the chalky fragments and reached under the seat, grasping for the spare key. I couldn't see her, but I knew she was only a few feet away. My fingertips finally grazed metal. I heaved the key into the ignition. The engine shuddered, then roared to life. I threw the truck into drive and slammed on the accelerator without even gripping the wheel, screeching onto the rocky asphalt, skidding in and out of potholes. And after a few seconds, the car stabilized. Cornstalks passed by at 40 miles an hour. My ragged breaths began to slow. Gradually, the rain stopped. I felt Rose becoming more and more distant. For a split second, I couldn't feel her at all. There was a brief, beautiful silence. Then, like a crack of lightning, I felt her again. Not behind me, not at the farmhouse. She was approaching from in front of me. Before I could react, her paralyzed smile appeared in the headlights. She was standing on the roadside, leaning forward, her head poised to hit the front windshield. Instinctively, I ducked. Her face struck the windshield. The collision itself was noiseless. No crunching of metal, no shattering of glass. The only new sound was the whoosh of cold air blustering through the truck. Rose quickly disappeared in the rearview mirror, unmoored, seemingly no worse for wear. I creaked upright, inspecting the damage. A perfect, face-shaped hole ran the length of the truck, exactly where my head had been before I ducked. Steam drifted from the metal edges. Once again, my connection to Rose dimmed, but it didn't leave me completely. It only truly disappears when she slips through the seams. Currently, I'm holed up in a cheap motel, about 10 miles from the farmhouse. Dan keeps calling. Once I'm a little farther away, I'll pick up. I don't want to risk him being caught in the crossfire. Rose is coming for me. Seems that part of her still wants me. A residual urge that refuses to fade despite her grievous mutations. I'm going to do whatever I can to evade her, but for better or worse, I'm connected to her now. She has my right hand. If I focus, I almost feel like I can wiggle my fingers. I don't know what exactly happened to her. Maybe my dad was right. Maybe the land is cracked at the seams. Maybe things slip through and end up somewhere else. A different, parallel place. Loosely tethered to our piece of reality. Wherever she disappeared to, it makes sense that Rose, of all people, would find a way to come back. When Rose wants something, she'll do anything in her power to make it manifest. We never had our wedding, but I think Rose and I are destined for a much deeper connection. Very, very soon. And that's the end of this story. I really hope you enjoyed this one. It was actually pretty creepy. If you did, let me know in the comments below if you're on YouTube or if you're listening on the podcast. Let me know. I'd appreciate hearing what you thought about the story and the narration. And if you haven't done so yet, go buy yourself a Stories After Midnight t-shirt. That would be awesome because, you know, well, just because there's some cool stuff over there. And if you'd like to support the channel, you can do so on Patreon. But outside of all of that, I just appreciate you listening. Stopping by and choosing this story to listen to, I know you have a lot of choices in your narration list. A lot of choices. So I thank you for choosing this one. Anyways, we'll see you next time.